welcome to We the People Radio. My name is Erin Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Debbie Bacigalupi, the sit-in guest.
Yeah,
host.
Welcome.
Got everybody in here
sure.
today. Got a full studio. Who's our sponsor this hour, Bill?
Our sponsor this hour is Team Power. The guys over at Team Power can do pretty much anything you want on the farm. We can work on tractors, work on mowers, work on pretty much anything. They can also give you a great deal on new equipment. Give them a call over there at 226-9226. They're at 3119 Twinview Boulevard. Or you can reach them on the web at readingtractors.com.
Can they stop global warming, Team Power?
Oh, they're already working on that. Yeah, guys out in the shop, they can. Man, they're tinkers. They can do it.
Tinkers. Classic. So
all
you can
right.
find all the information about the show. We're not going to goof off so much today because we have a great guest for you. But you can find everything about the program and our guest and all the things we're speaking about at WeThePeopleRadio.us. So our guest today is Dr. Patrick Moore. You might have heard of him. He's been in the news just a tiny bit. Lately, a little more than usual. And
yeah.
we have this guest through our friend, Debbie. So
yeah, and when Erin says a tiny bit, she is just kind of under-exaggerating.
Yeah, tiny bit.
Yeah, he's been in the news a lot. And ever since the green, new, raw, ugly deal has surfaced, it has been for many of us a gold mine. Because finally, after all these years of trying to expose this radical agenda called sustainable development, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has made it so easy for us to talk about what these radical extreme plans are. So
in case you've been living under a rock, Dr. Patrick Moore, I just thought, you know, for maybe our friends who aren't paying attention, Dr. Patrick Moore has been a leader in the environment, in the international environmental field for over 30 years. And contrary to Google and Wikipedia, he is the founding member of Greenpeace and served for 9 years as president of Greenpeace Canada and 7 years as director of Greenpeace International. He's the leader of many campaigns, and Dr. Moore was a driving force shaping policy and direction while Greenpeace became the world's largest environmental activist organization. On the web, you can find him at ecosense.me.
Ecosense.me. And correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Moore, you are the only PhD, the only doctor.
The only actual scientist?
Yes. At Greenpeace as co-founder?
Well, of course, I left Greenpeace now. It dates me pretty badly, 33 years ago. But I was in the leadership for 15 years from the beginning of the organization until I left because I disagreed with the direction my fellow directors were taking it, none of whom had any formal science education. So I don't know of any scientist that is actually in the leadership of Greenpeace today. They are mostly political activists and mostly on the extreme left, which is kind of why I left, because the extreme left took over Greenpeace after 15 years of activism in which we did a lot of good things, saving the whales and stopping nuclear testing, both underground and in the atmosphere, and eventually really focusing on toxic dumping into the air and water and cleaned up a lot of places around the world. So I'm proud of what we did back then, unfortunately, like they say, some organizations, they start out with good intentions. Eventually they change into a kind of business because they got 300 people on the payroll, and then they become a racket, and that's what happened mm-hmm. to Greenpeace.
So are you saying you've extracted yourself from the 98% of scientists that believe we're all going to die in 12 years?
Yeah. Yeah, well, that whole thing about the consensus is kind of laughable for two reasons. I mean, the first one is the hardcore one, and the fact is there are not 98 or 97 or whatever percent they say of scientists who believe that we are causing catastrophic climate change. And that's how they make it out. A large number of scientists do believe that humans are somehow involved in the changing climate in the last 150 years or so because we started using fossil fuels and put carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. But there's also a very large number of scientists who realize that is not the main cause of climate change. The climate has been changing through the eons and millennia ever since the Earth was born, and that most of the causes of climate change are natural, and the more I study it, the more I realize that probably pretty well all the changes that have occurred in the climate over the millions and thousands of years are naturally induced by a number of factors, one of which is greenhouse gases, but actually water vapor is the main greenhouse gas, and it is far more abundant in the atmosphere than carbon dioxide and is at least 95% of the greenhouse effect, which means that carbon dioxide is an insignificant player in the whole thing, even if it is, you know, has a bit part.
So where does the water vapor come from?
The ocean. Let me just give you the numbers. Carbon dioxide concentration in the global atmosphere is 0.04%. In other words, 0.04%.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not, I mean, 400 parts per million sounds like a lot, but it's 400 parts per million, which is 0.04%. Whereas water is in the lower atmosphere between 1% and 5%, which is 25 to 125 times as high a concentration as CO2. And in addition, water vapor has a higher band of absorption of infrared radiation, which is what a greenhouse gas does, and therefore molecule for molecule, water is a more powerful greenhouse gas than CO2, which relegates CO2 to somewhere between 1 and 3% of the greenhouse effect, which could easily be swamped by any number of other factors, because it's only if all else were equal that CO2 increasing would definitely cause some minor warming. But all else is never equal in these situations, where there are a multitude of factors all operating out of sync with each other in a chaotic fashion. And that is why virtually everybody who knows anything knows that you cannot predict the future of the global climate with a computer model, for example. There's nobody who's capable of understanding the relationships among all these factors in that kind of detail to be able to predict this in a computer model. And all these predictions of runaway climate change are based on computer models. Again, they behave as though a computer model is a crystal ball. Well, actually, the crystal ball is a mythical object. It cannot predict the future any more than a computer model can predict the future. The truth is, the output from a computer model is absolutely dependent on the inputs that you put into it.
Absolutely.
If you keep putting the same inputs into a computer model, it will never give you a different answer. It will always give you the same answer. And if the inputs you put in are not exactly right, it'll give you the wrong answer every time. And that's why it is foolish to believe people who are depending on computer models to predict the future of planet Earth, which is not the easiest thing. It was Yogi Berra who repeated someone else's statement. I'm not sure it was a scientist back further. But Yogi Berra liked to say predictions are difficult, especially about the future. And he was right about that.
Well, we've got to take a break here, but when we come back...
In a minute and a half.
Oh, in a minute and a half. Okay, well then,
it's not
I got
Bill's
a question.
Job.
If you have... True or false, the CO2 levels of the planet have been much, much higher in the distant past than they are today. How do we explain that?
Well, in fact, CO2 sunk to the lowest level in the history of the Earth, for those who don't know, is 4.6 billion years. It sunk to the lowest level in the history of the Earth 20,000 years ago at the height of the last glaciation, because that was the coldest it got in the last 100,000 years. And at the height of the glaciation, the oceans get colder and absorb more gases from the atmosphere. So they sucked a lot of the CO2 out of the atmosphere and brought it down to 180 parts per million. Today it's at 400. So, and it, coming out of the ice age, it went back up to 280 from 180. So as the oceans warmed up again, it gave off CO2. The oceans gave off CO2 into the atmosphere. Sorry, this is complicated, but...
Not really. I think really and truly, but for the numbers, we learned these ideas in sixth grade. You know, when you learn about CO2 and how it makes plants grow.
But we've been wrong.
No, we've been wrong the whole time. We have to take a really quick break. We're going to come back and we're going to chat some more about CO2 with our super special guest, Dr. Patrick Moore. And you're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them blue for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. Oh, under the sea, under the sea, nobody beat us, fry us, and eat us in fricassee. We want the land for not to cook. Under the sea, we have to hook up. We got no trouble. Land is the bubbles under the sea. Under the sea. Since life is sweet, we got to.
That was for Dr. Moore.
Yeah. We couldn't help it. We had to throw in a little mermaid for you.
Because we're talking to a doctor who understands ocean acidification and sea rise and all these things that we keep hearing about from people like Alexandria O'Communist. And these things that we're talking about on the show today on We the People Radio with Dr. Patrick Moore, Aaron Ryan, and Bill Cundiff and Debbie Bacigalupi.
I'm not near as qualified to talk about that as she is, because, you know, she was a bartender, and they talk to a lot of people.
They do.
And a lot of qualified people are in there drinking. And
everybody knows when you've been drinking, everybody sounds smarter.
Oh, yeah.
But I think the average person like me, who's, you know, when I go into a room with Dr. Patrick Moore, in fact, Dr. Patrick Moore, you're going to be speaking coming up at a conference that I am so honored to be a part of, and it's called Doctors for Disaster Preparedness. So, guys, look up online, Doctors for Disaster Preparedness. And I'm telling you, when I walk into that room, the whole IQ of the room is just going to drop.
Well, you have that to look forward to.
But, you know,
well, I appreciate it.
But something, Dr. Moore, that you're famous for, and I've seen your presentations. I was with you at the Paris conference, and where we had all those protesters protesting, all these great scientists like yourself. Dr. Bill Carter and Dr. Willie Soon. It was just a great lineup of people. As they want to refute your science, and one of your areas of expertise is, you know, this thing called ocean acidification. Can you tell us a little bit about it and what propaganda is being put out there that, you know, we could start as just common human beings, not with the IQ of a scientist, can come back and refute and say, hey, wait a minute, that's not true.
Well, you know, at least with global warming and carbon dioxide, there is this hypothesis that because CO2 is a greenhouse gas, it will cause a little warming. But with ocean acidification, you've actually got a complete 100% fabrication. There is no basis for this so-called hypothesis, because what they're saying is that the ocean will absorb more CO2. If we put more CO2 into the atmosphere, the ocean will absorb more CO2. And that is a distinct possibility. However, I was mentioning before the break that CO2 is now the lowest it's ever been in the history of the Earth. So the evolution of life for 3 billion plus years has taken place with far higher levels of CO2 in the atmosphere. As a matter of fact, CO2 was basically running out before we came along and started burning fossil fuels and putting some of the CO2 back into the atmosphere where it came from in the first place to make the fossil fuels, because they're made from plants. And plants sucked up fossil fuels to make themselves and then got buried and turned into coal and oil and gas. So ocean acidification is based on the idea that with CO2 at one of the lowest it's been in the history of the Earth, too much of it is going to get into the ocean and kill everything. So right off the bat, it's a stupid concept.
Yeah, that doesn't make sense.
Is that also part of the coral bleaching argument?
Oh, yeah. They always talk about that.
No, that's blamed on heat, that the ocean is too hot for the coral. But the problem with that argument is the area they've been focusing on is the Great Barrier Reef. And the Great Barrier Reef is actually not the hottest ocean in the world. The hottest ocean in the world is the oceans around Indonesia and the Philippines. And that is where the highest diversity of corals and reef fish exist on this planet. So if the highest diversity of corals and the highest diversity of reef fish exist in the hottest ocean on Earth, what are they doing telling us that the oceans are getting too hot? Because we know for a fact that when the Earth was hotter, corals spread over a much larger area of the globe. Now they're confined pretty much to deep equatorial zones. The fact is, coral can live in much warmer climates than it does now, but I see that the AOC Green New Deal is predicting, and I think the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change of the United Nations is saying the same thing, that 90% of the corals will die if the temperature goes up 2 degrees. Well, the temperature going up 2 degrees is nothing compared to how warm the Earth has been for hundreds of millions of years in the past, when coral reefs occupied a far larger area. So just by that, we know that ocean acidification is a crock.
The
main reason for knowing that it's phony is that they're making it seem as if the coral animals, like these are called the marine calcifiers, like coral reefs and shellfish, coccolithophores, which are a phytoplankton that make calcium carbonate shells for themselves, they're acting as though that calcification process is taking place in the sea. It is not. It is taking place inside these organisms where they control their internal biochemistry.
Oh.
And they can control their internal biochemistry like a muscle growing near the shoreline where a river comes out, where you have vast changes in pH, in salinity, in oxygen content, and every other thing. They survive there with a huge fluctuation in different ocean parameters. So there's no reason that this would affect all the species of coral and calcifying species in the sea in any different way. It's a complete fabrication. It's totally made up. It has no basis in fact, and you don't actually hear a lot about it anymore since I wrote my paper, peer-reviewed, double-blind paper, showing that it was a complete fabrication about 4 years ago.
So what?
But they still talk about it.
So what's causing the coral bleaching, or is it even happening?
Coral bleaching is caused when the ocean heats up to an extreme temperature above 30 degrees Celsius for a period of time. And most people don't know, but corals are a symbiotic relationship between an animal and a plant. The polyp, which is the animal, is living inside the coral, and little hole where it comes out, its tentacles come out at night, and it feeds, just like many marine species do. They have tentacles that come out and feed on plankton in the sea. But corals also take in plankton into their bodies, plankton of a particular species. The thing that makes coral a color is the plankton inside them. Because the animal in there, plankton being a plant, of course, so they're a combination of an animal and a plant. The animal is clear. It has no color. So when the polyp ejects the plankton when it's hot, this is what happens during bleaching, is they eject their plankton, then the coral becomes white because they are basically see-through, and the coral is made of calcium carbonate, which is white. And so you see the skeleton, it looks like a skeleton of the coral, when in fact living animals are still inside there. And when the water cools down, they take the plankton back in. The color of the coral is dependent on the species of the plankton that it is taken in. They're extremely selective in that way. They don't just take in any old phytoplankton. They take in a species that they prefer, and the plankton then is doing photosynthesis and giving them sugar. In return, the zooplankton gives the phytoplankton, the plant, protection from predators because it's inside the polyp.
Sure.
So it's a complicated thing. Coral reefs are an amazing creature that has done this and creates these huge, I call it calcium carbonate reefs, which is what limestone is made from. Limestone, marble, and chalk are all of life origin, made by marine calcifying species, which learn to do this, many different species. You know, it's crabs and shrimp and lobsters and clams and mussels and barnacles. and all the shellfish and the corals, and then there's a number of zooplankton and phytoplankton, which are so extremely small people don't know about them, but the foraminifera and the coccolithophores, the former a zooplankton, an animal, the latter a phytoplankton, a plant, also make calcareous shells for themselves. So many marine species learned to make armor plating out of calcium carbonate to protect their soft bodies from predation. And as a result, they are combining carbon dioxide with calcium in the water and pulling CO2 out of the ocean. And when the plants and animals that do this die, their skeletons fall on the bottom and form the limestone, marble, and chalk deposits that amount to 8% of the Earth's crust. This has been going on for 500 million years.
That's fascinating.
And I could go on for 500 million years, too, but please don't let me.
No. My gosh. I want to go down scuba diving right now. I'm not kidding. I'm like itching to go scuba diving, Dr. Moore. And check
you
out
go
these
to Indonesia. Go to the Komodo Islands from Bali and over to Flores, or go up into Raja Ampat in Papua, which used to be called Irian Jaya. And now called Papua. It's part of Papua, where Papua New Guinea is the eastern end of it and Papua is the western end of it. Up in there, you just go into the Coral Triangle anywhere. The Solomon Islands are included. The Philippines are included. And pretty much the whole of the eastern part of the Indonesian Sea is included. And that is where the highest diversity of corals and rockfish are, the reef fish are. And if you go there and spend a week snorkeling there, you will wonder if heaven could be any better.
Oh,
see, and all this scare tactic, you know, that we're killing the ocean and bleaching the coral and this and that, it plays really well because most people haven't seen that themselves. And so they're just taking these folks' word for it. And we all, Jim? What's his name? He always talks about
it. Oh, Hansen.
No, Jim, the other one, the funny one.
And
he always talks about it's fear porn. He said, you know, people have just gotten addicted to fear porn on all this stuff. They just like to be scared. So they give them a bad scenario, and they just keep reading more about how bad it is.
Well, whether it's sea rise or plastic in the ocean or coral bleaching or ocean acidification.
Well, we're currently sitting in a state that banned straws. We're going to save the world by banning drinking straws. We've got to take
The presentation I'm giving at the Doctors for Disaster Preparedness in July in Tucson is titled 12 Fake Invisible Catastrophes and Threats of Doom.
Nice.
Can't wait.
Classic.
My hypothesis is that because people can't see things that are invisible, like CO2 and whatever's supposed to be bad inside GM food and radiation from nuclear reactors, they can't see that, so people can make up stories however they want about all of that that's going on. And even really remote things like polar bears and coral reefs, who can go and count the coral reefs and the polar bears and check out their health? So when things are
zero
invisible
people
or remote, we depend on activists and scientists who are on the government payroll and media to tell us what's going on. We can't see for ourselves. And so that's why most of these scare stories are about things that are invisible or remote.
Exactly. We're going to take a really quick break. Our guest is Patrick Moore, Dr. Patrick Moore. He is a PhD in ecology with the Institute of Resource Ecology and the University of British Columbia back in 1972. So, and it got really quiet all of a sudden. You're listening to We the People. Join us online at wethepeopleradio.us. is going to be a nice, bright, sunshiny day one of these days. We're having protracted rain here. Dr. Moore, can you go? Do you want to talk a little bit about your erasure from history before we run out of time? I mean, we've got some time left, but because that's a very interesting phenomenon. If you pipe up against the established environmental machinery, they erase you regardless of your knowledge or your history in the movement or any of that. You just got eliminated from, wasn't it Wikipedia or something?
Wikipedia and Google.
You're now not involved. You never had any involvement with Greenpeace, even though you started it.
Well, they're basically ashamed of me because I'm telling the truth.
That's why we like you.
So, historical revisionism is as old as the hills. You know, and George Orwell understood that in his book 1984, where he basically says, you know, if you control the past, you control the present, and if you control the present, you control the future. And what these people are doing is they are basically trying to erase the fact that I was one of the founding directors of Greenpeace and on the first voyage of Greenpeace. And then, unlike anyone else, spent the next 15 years in their leadership going as we evolved into an international organization. My last 6 years, where I was still president of Greenpeace Canada during that period because it was one of the national organizations, I was also one of five directors of Greenpeace International. And so I was in the top committee for those 15 years, and not many other people survived that at either a life level or a political level, which, because you can imagine the internal politics in an organization like that. And so, the thing that bothers me the most is Wikipedia will not let the subject of their biography, a living person, contribute to their own biography without going through all these committees, whereas other people just can come in and change your biography and then have to defend it later. And that's what's happened recently with my biography, is they have got some kind of adjudication out of these bunch of leftists who edit the Wikipedia website that, on balance, I'm not really a founder of Greenpeace, and they've changed my PhD from ecology to forestry. Now, I'd be perfectly happy to have a PhD in forestry, but my PhD is actually in ecology, so I think I should be allowed to have that in my biography. And there's a whole bunch of other stuff in there. They color every single thing about me negatively. And so I've got to figure out now how to get into Wikipedia and get that changed, because the reason Google took me off the list of the founders of Greenpeace is because Wikipedia did. And Google has some kind of algorithm that goes out into the cloud and collects this information from what's in Wikipedia, I think.
And
I'm
do that. I love this example, just like I love that we have Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez now, because without AOC, you know, we've been piping up for years and years, you included, Dr. Moore, about this, you know, this radical agenda for the 21st century. And now that, you know, she's come out, she's made our work easier for us. And same with Wikipedia, because I, the other day, went into the history section of Wikipedia, one of the tabs, and you can compare current versions of the Wikipedia for Greenpeace, for example, to older versions. And I went back to 2018, and sure enough, it says that you were one of the co-founders and, you know, a critic of Greenpeace, a co-founder and a critic of Greenpeace. I think, if I remember correctly, now in 2019, they have you as a critic of Greenpeace.
So he was a blasphemer, so, you know.
And so, you know, all these I like to call them anti-human humans, because they truly are against, you know, truth and some of us human beings. You know, it just gives an opportunity for people to do an easy research on for themselves to find out how what we're saying is actually true. We're not making this up. This is not hype. They are trying to erase you.
Yes, that's right. And, you know, I was going to mention, though, that I'm really happy you have a sponsor who sells tractors, because I'm huge on ag and farmers. Most people, I think, believe their food comes from the supermarket, but I'm much more aware of that they actually have farms out there in the country where they're toiling every day in different weather conditions, and, you know, they put farmers down almost, and yet farmers probably know more about the weather and the climate than any other category of people on Earth. But what really makes me laugh about the AOC things is I bet those tractor people are really looking forward to the battery-powered tractors and combines they're going to have to
use solar power
to grow the food one of these days, you know, and also the battery-powered semi-trailer trucks that have to carry 40 tons of food into the middle of New York City so that people don't starve to death in their high-rise there.
Well, it's funny, funny you mentioned that because here, I think it was two or three years ago, UC Davis came out with a program where their students were going to, they had the farming thing all figured out, and they knew how to do it better than the actual farmers, and they were going to go out and prove it and raise crops in a much more efficient
sustainable manner.
And I don't think that program lasted much past a year, and they realized, my God, I've got to get my hands dirty. And I've got to work hard, and it's hot,
sweaty
work, and maybe you guys know how to do it better than we do. And they dropped the whole thing. You don't hear anything about it now. It's amazing.
Well, it's too bad what's happened to the universities. At least when I went to university, was I hate to tell you how long ago that was, but I was lucky. I had really good talks, and I got a really decent education. And ahead of my PhD committee, quoting a famous Canadian who said, get out of the ivory tower and get into the control tower. And so that really affected me. I realized I should, instead of just going back into teaching after I'd been taught, because they do say something about that, or about how those who can do and those who can't teach. I mean, it's not a very nice thing to say, but I wanted to learn how to do things and to get out into the real world and figure things out. And I've been very lucky in being able to do that and to have had quite a few different roles as time has gone along in many different areas. After I left Greenpeace, it's 33 years now, and I've done a lot of things that I've really enjoyed. And it's actually kind of nice now to get a little bit of media after being in the woodshed for a long time, because I was the main spokesman for Greenpeace for many, many years. And when I left, I got kind of shut out by the mainstream. But now I find that it's only the fake news that's saying I'm not a founder of Greenpeace. And, of course, the anti-everything eco people, the so-called green people. But I'm being recognized as the co-founder of Greenpeace in many platforms and many media and blogs, and so that's quite gratifying.
Yeah.
Well, I'm curious. Your book, Confessions of a Greenpeace Dropout, The Making of a Sensible Environmentalist, is I'm sure a must read. I don't have it yet, so I'm assuming it's in the book. But we've got, you know, 2 or 3 minutes here till we have to take another break. And I was just curious if you could kind of give us the elevator speech on why you left. You know, I mean, what were the, because, I mean, I'm 57, so I kind of saw a little bit of what Greenpeace was doing. But for people who weren't paying attention or who maybe are too young, 30 years ago, how did they go off the rails in your mind? Like, what was it made you want to walk away?
You know, when we started, we had a very strong humanitarian orientation to save human civilization from all of nuclear war, which we also realized would be an environmental catastrophe at the same time. So we combined green and peace, with green being the environment and peace being human civilization living peacefully together. And so as time went on and we saved the whales and got into the baby seals and the toxic waste, somehow that peace sort of got dropped off and all that was left was the green. And by the time I left in the mid-80s, human beings were being characterized as the enemies of nature, the enemies of the Earth, as if we were from Mars or something. When in fact, the first rule of ecology is that all life is one, evolved from the same life in the beginning. And we're no different than the other species in that sense. We're not like some kind of alien being. And to suggest that humans are the only bad species is way too much like original sin for me, and I'm not into that sort of way of thinking about people, that we're the only bad thing on the planet. And so that was the high level. The sharp end of the stick, though, was my fellow directors decided that Greenpeace should adopt its next campaign to ban chlorine worldwide. I said, you guys, it's one of the elements in the periodic table, you know.
Like, chlorine.
I'm not sure we can be banning one of those. But more importantly, adding chlorine to drinking water and our swimming pools and spas was the biggest advance in the history of public health to prevent waterborne communicable diseases from spreading. And most of our synthetic pharmaceuticals, medicines, are made with chlorine chemistry because it's toxic to bacteria and therefore the most important element for medicine. And so it fell on deaf ears with, you know, they just said, oh, we'll figure that out later, you know. And so they embarked upon a campaign to ban chlorine worldwide, and I left because I could not be in an organization that was campaigning on something so stupid as that.
You get down to the part where you start looking around and go, I think these guys might be dummies. Huh, well, that's a good reason to leave. That makes perfect sense.
You're not kidding. Today, they've morphed into like a bunch of college kids on a summer cruise, let me tell you. They've got a $32 million boat, and they're floating around the world on it pretending it's a sailboat when it has an 1,850-horsepower diesel engine in it.
Uh-oh. Oopsie.
We had like a $40,000 boat, and we saved the whales with it, you know.
We've got to take a really quick break, but I'll tell you what, the mocking on that topic could go on forever.
It could.
Really, really quick break here. You're listening to We the People Radio. Our guest is Dr. Patrick Moore. You can find everything about the program and listen to the archive after and send it to a friend. You can get it at wethepeopleradio.us.
Me and all my friends, we're all misunderstood. They say we stand for nothing and there's no way. Now we see everything that's going wrong with the world and those who lead it. Just feel like we don't have the means to rise above and beat it. So we keep waiting, waiting, waiting on the world to change. We keep on waiting, waiting, waiting on the world to change.
Tell you what, the silliness goes on and on and on. So if we could here in this last segment, if there's one other part that, you know, if you were king for a day and you could just, you know, give everyone an injection so they could figure out this one thing, what would you pick, Dr. Moore?
I would say that carbon dioxide is the building block of life, the currency of life on this planet. And is not a pollutant, and they should stop demonizing it because they got it exactly 100% backwards. The fact of the matter is all life on Earth is carbon-based. The carbon in all carbon-based life comes from one and only one molecule, and that is carbon dioxide in the air and in the water. All the carbon dioxide came from the interior of the Earth when it was much hotter through volcanic action, in the same as the water did. H2O and CO2 are combined by plants to make sugars like glucose, which is a carbohydrate, carbo-carbon hydrate water. Those two are the most important building blocks of all life. And the sugar is the basis of the energy for all life, including ourselves and the birds and everything else. So carbon dioxide is the central molecule in life. And as far as we know, the life on this Earth is the only life in the universe. You can guess all you want that maybe there's another million planets with life on them somewhere, but we don't know of one. This is the only one we actually know of. So if we were reasonable in our thinking, I'm not saying we should worship carbon dioxide, but we should certainly give it its rightful place in the scheme of things, which is that it is the building block of life, and we should be knowledgeable of that.
And why is that so? I mean, okay, so Leighton Stewart was on our program a bunch of years ago, actually, and he was talking about CO2, and he had said, he had told us, really simple math, 400 parts per million of CO2 in the regular air as we're standing around. But if somebody were to drop on the ground and you did mouth-to-mouth resuscitation on them, you would breathe into them 40,000 parts per million of CO2. And so if CO2 is a pollutant, everyone we ever did mouth-to-mouth resuscitation on should have died instantly. And yet they did not. And every
That is correct. Our breath is 1,000 times when we exhale, is 1,000 times the level of the CO2 that we breathed in, because we take in oxygen and oxidize the sugars and the starches and the fats which we make from the sugars in our bodies and breathe out carbon dioxide as a waste product from us ourselves as animals. And then that waste product feeds the plants. So the Earth's life system has evolved into a beautiful cycle where the plants use CO2 to make sugars, and then we eat the sugars, and we make CO2 back for the plants again. They make the oxygen for us. There was no oxygen in the atmosphere until plants evolved. It is purely a life-made substance in the atmosphere, whereas carbon dioxide came from the middle of the Earth, as did water. But the oxygen in the atmosphere came from living things, and it's the only reason we can survive. If people don't understand that very fundamental aspect of the water and the oxygen and the carbon dioxide, I mean, then something's really wrong. And, you know, the problem is the politicians, right at the top end of it, the Greens create the scare stories in the media. But the politicians pay the scientists to give them scare stories dressed up in sciencey stuff so that they can scare the people into voting for them on the basis that they're going to save their kids and grandchildren from a terrible end in fire and brimstone. Like this idea that the world is going to end in 12 years, are there three people out of the 7.5 billion who actually believe that? I just can't understand how many people fall for this stuff. The truth is, though, is that in a poll that was done very recently, out of 20 issues that are top-of-mind issues in the public, climate change was number 18. And from what I understand, the average, when most people are asked of how much they would spend to solve this problem, is like $10. No, people really don't like carbon taxes, and they don't like to have to pay. On the other hand, The climate catastrophe, climate crisis people make them feel guilty for driving their SUV, so they feel guilty that they're going to kill their grandchildren, and they're afraid. So fear and guilt together is what the climate thing is all about, and fear and guilt together opens people's wallets. And so it's really just, it is a racket, the whole thing. It's not just a hoax and a scam. It's an actual racket.
It is. If you go back, if you can find a copy of Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth, you could almost go page by page and debunk every single thing he predicted in that book, because it's already come to pass. The timelines that he's put on all that stuff has already come and gone, and none of it happened. So you would think that people would kind of take a step back and go, wow, maybe this isn't true.
Maybe he's a dum-dum.
Well, here we are again now with OAC or AOC or
Alexandria O-Communist.
O-Communist, yes. Now, here we are again. 12 years from now, we're all going to die. I'm with you. I don't think there's a whole lot of people out there that believe any of it. But yet, here we are.
But the frightening part is, well, Debbie and I were looking for music for a group of shows that we've pre-recorded here. We were looking for music, and I swear almost, well, I'm going to say 90% of the songs that are online that are about the environment are being sung by children.
Yeah, it was overwhelming, and the views have been like 30 million to 100 million.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're the little kids.
The little kids are the educators.
And just coming back, sorry to not give Dr. Moore some time here in these last few seconds here.
He only has 2.5 minutes.
But, you know, I just got back from the most recent United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, and Dr. Moore, I cannot express to you how many young people were at this conference, and like you, I've been to several of these conferences, and And,
they all drove there,
we
right?
were shocked at how many, and teenagers and elementary school students that, you know.
Yes, but they are being brought there by adults like Al Gore.
Absolutely. Yep.
And this is absolutely child abuse, what they are doing. It's worse than child abuse, if you could find anything worse than that. Because this is what Nazis do. This is what communists do. They use children, and they get them to sing songs about the great Hitler youth and all of that, you know. This is what they're doing. They're using children to appeal to people because people love children. And then when children are taught to do doomsday stories, you know, and this thing about, you know, Al Gore and all his predictions not come true. The problem is people have a memory of about 10 years. So somebody says, we have 10 years to save the world from doom. 10 years goes by, doom doesn't happen. They say, oh, yes, but we only have 10 more years to save the world from doom.
It's a cycle.
David Suzuki, who is a famous Canadian environmental catastrophe guy, has done it four times in his lifetime. They just keep repeating it. And it's been actually repeated throughout the ages. The end is nigh. A guy standing on the corner with a sign that says the end is nigh has been going on for thousands of years, and it never comes true. Yes, there are wars and horrible circumstances, but those are caused by bad people. And the people who are driving their cars and putting CO2 into the atmosphere are actually returning a balance to the global carbon cycle by fertilizing the plants. And that's why we have to turn this whole narrative completely on its head, because it's 100% backwards. Carbon dioxide is entirely beneficial to both the planet, the environment, and to civilization, because it will make our food crops grow faster, and it will make the earth greener. So it's good all around. There's nothing bad about it. And if it does make the planet a slight bit warmer, that will be good too, because this is one of the coldest periods in the history of planet Earth. If you go back hundreds of millions of years, it's been warmer than it is today 99% of the time, and life flourished on this planet all through those warm periods. This is a fact.
Well, we appreciate the time. We are flat out of time, but I hope people will go to wethepeopleradio.us and read your article, The Positive Role of Human Emissions of CO2.
And get
his
book.
And we've been visiting with Dr. Patrick Moore. Thank you so much. We really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you. I love your music policy, by the way.
Outstanding. We'll have you back anytime.
All right.